Wind horse is our innate ability to uplift ourselves and our environment by giving rise to a positive energy that is both relaxed and disciplined. Since 1981, Wind horse Community Services has integrated this understanding with modern conventional therapies, meditation, and contemplative traditions in the development of at-home, whole-person mental health recovery. Wind horse Journal is dedicated to the mission of communicating decades of clinical and personal experience to professionals, educators, students, and anyone seeking recovery options. Please join the dialogue.
Welcome to Wind horse Journal Entry 051, Swimming Lessons, the first of a series of conversations with Joanne Greenberg, writer, teacher, firefighter, confrere of Dorothy Gale, wife and mother. Joanne Greenberg invited Wind horse Journal to her cozy hilltop home near Golden, Colorado for conversations relating to her celebrated semi-autobiographical novel, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. This will be the first of a series of podcasts produced from those conversations. Joining Joanne are Rabbi Deborah Bronstein and Senior Wind horse Community Services clinicians Jeff Fortuna and Chuck Knapp. Let's listen now to Wind horse Journal Entry 051, Swimming Lessons, the first of a series of conversations with Joanne Greenberg.
Joanne, I'm going to read kind of an introduction here, and if you think this sounds too correct...
You know what I told you.
I did. Tempestuous.
The lovely and tempestuous.
Lovely and tempestuous. You may add that later. I'm gonna play it straight here for a second.
Okay.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Wind horse Journal. Today, we're so pleased to be joined by our dear friend, Joanne Greenberg. Most of you will know Joanne as she's the internationally renowned best-selling author of the book, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, which was originally published under the pen name of Hannah Green. For those of you who don't know Rose Garden, it is a semi-autobiographical book about several years in the life of a teenage girl who was diagnosed with schizophrenia. So that was you, Joanne.
Yeah.
It was later adapted into a 1977 movie and a 2004 play of the same name, which...
I didn't like the movie. I liked the play.
Yeah, I liked the play. Oh, good. Okay, that's good to know. And I won't say anything about the song. Okay. If you haven't read the book, and if you have any interest in extreme state mental illness, this is an amazing work of subtlety, power, and beauty. I can't recommend the book strongly enough. Along with now having written 20 novels and 4 sets of short stories. Do I have that right?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. Joanne, you also taught writing and anthropology at the Colorado School of Mines in Golden, and you were also a volunteer firefighter and paramedic for approximately 15 years. You are now retired.
Retired.
All right. Yeah. So, Joanne, in the way of introductions, is there anything else that would be good for us to know at this point?
Oh, gosh. Well, I taught bar mitzvah classes, and now I teach Hebrew to anybody who likes biblical Hebrew, which is very practical in case some great sage from 3,000 years ago shows up. We're ready.
We're also joined by 2 distinguished members of the Wind horse community, Deborah Bronstein and Jeff Fortuna. Jeff and Deborah, would you please introduce yourselves?
I'm Jeff Fortuna, and Joanne, you and I have gotten to know each other over the last, 10 plus years, maybe more, which I appreciate. I am one of the co-founders of the Wind horse Project from nearly 40 years ago now, and have really devoted most of my life to developing the project further. And whatever good we've done in the Wind horse work, it's somehow created a bridge to getting to know you, Joanne, which is really a privilege.
Just thank you.
A privilege.
Same for me.
I handed you my old copy of I Never Promised You a Rose Garden when you came to speak at Har Hashem in 1995, I think, and asked you to sign it.
Uh-huh.
And so I looked at it again this morning, and apparently I stole it from my high school. It's this Brighton High School. And I had a wonderful mentor woman in my life named Mrs. Partridge, and she let me stay in her reading room all day long, and she would give me books that she thought would ease my soul because I was pretty depressed.
Yes.
And your book really eased my soul. And so that's how I feel like I've gotten to know you.
Thank you. That is so great to hear. Thank you.
You came and spoke at my synagogue. And then a few years ago, I again had a severe time with depression, and I've been a patient with Windhorse, and they helped me refine you through Jeff.
And you've written one hell of a book, and I hope that somebody besides the two of us are going to read it.
Deborah, do you also want to say a little bit about you're a rabbi?
Oh, yeah. So I've been a rabbi since 89. When I became a rabbi, there weren't that many of us.
No.
Kind of like being a firefighter.
Well.
I worked as an assistant in Los Angeles. Really, there was nobody who wanted a female rabbi. And Har Hashem really took a risk on me.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a great time together.
That's Colorado.
Yeah.
That's my Colorado.
Joanne, I wanted to ask you to talk with us some about I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. I got a new copy recently, and I'm remembering that I had a copy when I was 20.
Uh-huh.
So as I was looking at it, I thought, now, wait a minute. This book, I knew this book, and I read this book. So I was a junior in college 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And remember reading this book at the time when I was searching for what to do with my life that could resemble meaning, being meaningful, something in that direction. Read this book, which I think was 5 years after it was published. So it was around 1969 that I was reading it.
Yeah.
So if you could just say a little bit about how you came to write this amazing
book. It's quite a story.
So please, if you could just share some of
that. I left the hospital and I said, I am through with this. Anything with PSI on it, I don't care. I don't want it. I'm not doing it. In those days, the stigma was 10 times what it is now. And you had sanity papers. You had to show everybody. You had it on your driver's license in Maryland. You had it here, 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 and here. So if you do anything is you lie. And you lie and lie and lie. I lied myself into college, and I never was in. I went places, and I lied, and I lied, and I lied. And I got engaged, got jilted, went to England, cried, lied, came back, did go to college, got engaged again. I didn't lie then, I just didn't tell the truth.
Yeah.
And this is going to be one long agony for you guys. It takes a long time to tell it. I did a favor for a friend, and I went to an evening. And at the evening, there were four guys who were interested in this friend of mine, and I was just tagging along because one woman at the house with four guys, they're not so good. So there I was. And I sat around in that evening, and I realized that I had never, ever been as comfortable and easy at any time in my life hacking it out with these guys. And one of them said that he had signed up to work at the lodge where I had been, but that they didn't do work with alcoholics. And I said, yes, they do. And then he said something else, and I corrected that. And he said, oh, you work there. And all of a sudden, I got so damn tired of the lie. I couldn't stand the lie anymore. And I said, no, I was a patient. And the guy said, they did a hell of a job. And we got married. And I wrote a book. And then they captured Adolf Eichmann. Now, you're wondering what the hell Adolf Eichmann has to do with me. I don't know either. But all of a sudden, it was like eating a bad meal and think you digested it, and all of a sudden you threw up. And all the Jews threw up. We all of us, threw up. They were talking about it in the news and in the newspapers and on TV and in the movies. And Bruno Bettelheim, whom I later met under very ghastly circumstances, had written a story in Harper's Magazine, an article called The Forgotten Lesson of Anne Frank, in which he said that Jews had a death wish, a 4,000-year-old death wish, that Jews had a death wish, and that Anne Frank and her passivity of hiding was not what they should have done or would have done. And here I had two little boys, Jewish, and I was wondering about this whole thing, and I was at a Christmas party, and I cornered Walt Plywoski, who lives in Boulder, and was a Holocaust survivor, and I nailed him to the wall, and I said, discourse on this. Why does this guy say this? And he said, if you have a memory that is away from anything that you experienced before or since, of depth of for you, you're going to do either one of two things. You're going to forget it or you're going to change it. Bettelheim has obviously changed it. I have more or less forgotten it. It's still there, but I've forgotten it. And I just thought, in that little quiet place in your mind, I haven't changed it too much. I better start, and I certainly haven't forgotten it, so I better write it down before I change it too much.
Yeah.
Now, I am not comparing myself to a Holocaust survivor. Know that. But it was a very hard life before. And what's happened since is absolutely beyond my wildest imaginings. As a human being, as a woman, as a mother, as a wife, as a Hebrew teacher, as a firefighter, as an anything. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And that was true then. I had already written a book about the York Massacre, 1190, England. Could I do this? Could I take personal experience and make it art in some way? Every book has about 3-4 problems in it, and one of them is psychological, always. Can I do this? Can I go there? It's a windy answer to a short question.
But a full wind. This book has remained relevant for 50 years plus. How is it that a book like this could continue to, in a sense, create the wind of its own story, like keep blowing in a relevant way for 50 years? What's the relevance of this?
I hope so. People tell me that no is now about medication, it's about the brain, it's about this, it's about this, it's about that.
Yeah. I was looking through the book, and it looked to me, so Dr. Free was Frieda Fromm Reichman, the famous psychiatrist, and it looked to me that she was coining the phrase, she kept reminding you, at least the section I was reading, something like, this is going to be tough, Joanne, I never promised you, I didn't promise you a rose garden, you know that.
Yeah.
So did she actually suggest the title, and what did she mean by that?
No, it was called A Little Maybe. Remember, I had written one book, and it was pretty successful.
Yeah.
And so they said, you're going to write this other book. And I said, yes, I want to call it The Little Maybe. And they said, no, that sounds too much like a children's book. So get something else. Well, she said, I didn't promise you a garden of roses, or I didn't promise you roses, something like that. And I said, well, okay, you don't like that, do this. And they said, well, it's too long. And I said, well, never mind, do it anyway. By that time, I had a certain amount of say-so.
It sounds like, in a way, you've, through the progression of your life and what you were just saying a little bit ago about where things have come to, that you've actually come to a rose garden.
Who knew?
Who could have known?
I always think it wasn't meant to be this way.
Yeah.
As it started when I was 3 or 4, 5. So, I mean,
is that what you mean?
Being sick.
Yeah.
Knowing I was sick. I think we all know. The popular thing is, if you think you're crazy, you're not, and if you don't think you're crazy, you are, or
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
I think we all know.
Yeah.
We blow square bubbles.
Because, Joanne, you just started to go towards a question you're actually starting to name right now, which is illness.
Which and is what?
The mm-hmm. sense of illness.
Yeah.
I think it was about 2012 at an ISPS conference.
Uh-huh.
And someone asked you about who was feeling sensitive about the term mental illness.
Uh-huh.
And that they didn't like that term and what you thought of it. And you basically said, I was so relieved to hear
oh,
that
yeah.
I had an illness. And I would love to hear you say a little bit more about the difference between not knowing and knowing.
Well, I know what I know. I know that I am, in some profound way, not fitting in. And I think when you're a kid, when you're 8 or 9, you think, well, she has nice clothes. She has a red jacket. She talks this way. Her hair is this way. If you'd only get that red jacket or that hair or that, you could be that, and you do, and it doesn't work. And you try this, you try that. You feel like you're given a half yard of fabric to cover yourself, so you, the top is here, well, there's the bottom. The bottom is here, where's the top? Whatever it is, it isn't right. It isn't fitting. It doesn't work. And you try and try and try and try again. And then somebody comes along and says, there's a word for this. There's a name for it. That means that way underneath, there's ground. I knew it. I knew it all the time. And now you come along and validate it and tell me, yes, you're sick as hell. You should be in a hospital. Wow.
Mm-hmm. And you lived with a sense that there was something wrong for a number of years before that validation.
I was 5.
Okay. And you were 16 when you went into Chestnut Lodge?
I was 16, but I was 13 when I was diagnosed as being that. The doctor said, you really need to be someplace, and there's no place for you.
Yeah.
If you can hang on the bough until you're 16, I can get you where I want you to be. That's what I did. I was 14. Now, I think if there had been a place, I might have gotten out a year earlier, because I think you sort of stuff it down. I don't know how to describe it better.
I had shared with you something I had written that had a quote from R.D. Lang
uh-huh.
about schizophrenics and mystics find themselves in the same ocean, but the mystics swim, whereas the schizophrenics drown.
Very good.
Yeah. You really resonated with that drowning image.
I really do. There's my psychiatric joke I like.
You know, I was taken by that joke. Would you share it, please?
He wanted to be a scuba diver. So he got the lessons, 3 months' worth of lessons. And he had to get state-of-the-art equipment. He got the fins, he got the head, he got the all kinds of stuff. And he got a special slate with a special pencil that he could write his impressions underwater. It was all worth it, all the money, all the time. Down there in the Caribbean with the fish were swimming and the fronds were fronding, and he was down underwater just exulting. This is just wonderful. And over there is this guy. He hasn't had a lesson, obviously. Look at him paddling, messing around. He has no proper equipment. The whole thing's a mess. The guy gets irritated down there, and he writes on the slate, what are you doing down here? Shows the guy the slate. The guy takes the pencil and writes back, drowning.
Yeah. And that really does hit.
It really does
hit the mark. Yeah.
This is an argument that I had. R.D. Lang, a lot of the other stuff he says made me feel that he was a big pill. There is nothing creative in this state whatsoever. I think you're right, you paint in spite of, not because of, A. And B, drag up all these creative people who are also seriously ill. I give you in any population. What about the good, healthy writers who are writing away fat, dumb, and happy and doing what they like to do? But I got in an argument with Carl Menninger, in public, no less. And he was talking about problems. We all have problems. Well, I didn't know about Lang, and I said, some of us are swimming and some of us are drowning. And there's a big difference. Yeah, we're in the same ocean. But he wanted to say that people should say, well, you have problems, you have serious problems. We all have problems, so we're all the same. I think that when you talk to people who are caregivers, you should say that. When you talk to people who are given the care, you shouldn't. Because I can tell you that there is a direction in which you should be swimming. If you're drowning or swimming, you should be swimming. I give you the direction. I give you north, then you've got south, east, and west. You know which way to steer your boat. Does that make any sense to you? Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it's perfectly all right to tell somebody that they're sick as hell. Mm-hmm. I knew it. I knew it all the time.
I had a member of my congregation who was really sick as hell, and we spent a lot of time together. And I don't think he knew he was sick as hell, or he wouldn't admit to it. And
I don't think you admit to it.
He just felt like he had been mistreated in his life, and he was really suffering a lot, and then he took his life.
Did he get any benefits out of his illness?
I think he got attention.
Okay. I had one doctor tell me once that my chances were very good. He said, what you have hurts so much that you will do anything
to get out of it.
To get out of it. There is no reward for you mm-hmm. in this thing. Mm-hmm. And I think I knew people in the hospital who had rewards somehow.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not recommending that any sick person be hit regularly with a broom handle. But I think it's very hard when there are enough rewards for being cuckoo not to be. Frida used to say, I'm asking you to dive off a diving board without being sure that there's any water in the lake. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an unknown. You're diving into what is completely unknown. Go ahead and do it.
In that sense, Joanne, would, for example, the psychotherapy process be involved in having the person feel the depth of the suffering that they're involved in?
No.
Well, what would be the issue with that?
Why am I so adamant?
Yeah.
Look, you're no help to me when you're suffering. I'm looking at you. You are understanding my metaphor, which nobody else has. And I'm looking at you in a sense for that stability and that sanity.
Yeah.
I have all the crazy. I don't need yours. I have all the crazy I can have.
Yeah.
Back in the 60s, they were talking about sharing the suffering and all that stuff.
Yeah.
What good is that to me? Frida, occasionally, I compare us to working a mine. I've got the map. She's got the light. And we're in this mine. We're mining together, but she also has the height, which is really funny. She was about 5 feet tall, and she's an inch. We once had an accident on I-70. A guy had broken bilateral femoral fracture. Trying to get a car, and the jack slipped, and bang. Both femurs. That's about a 10 on the pain chart. He was begging me to kill him. And I said, I know something you don't know is coming along. If you can hang on for another 4 minutes, five at the outside, there's going to be a whole bunch of guys here, and they're going to do something called a hair splint. And the pain is going to be cut in half. Meanwhile, I'm going to sit with you and we're going to chat. You're going to tell me the story of your life, starting with your childhood. We're going to chat here for a while and wait for these guys. I have the height over this situation that you don't have. And so it was. Mm-hmm. By the way, we called the chopper. They dropped him.
Oh.
But she had the light and she had the height. I had the map.
Yeah.
So we were co-miners. Yeah. We were miners together. But one of us wasn't suffering. I think there's a difference between being in the mine and suffering the mine.
Mm. You're describing being in relationship with someone who isn't super ill at that point. You know, they're in a place where they're not drowning, and they can be helpful. And I don't know, Deborah, if that...
Yeah. Looking back over all of this, how would you describe mental health? And maybe how do you describe health in general?
Health in general. It's almost unbelievable, the difference, the distance between one and the other. And yet it's so close. Health is not the absence of sickness. The difference between not being sick and being healthy is very wide, very big. It's a big difference. You know what schwach is. Okay.
Weak. Kind of.
Well, you're not like, sick, you're not...
You're kind of...
How would you put that into words for people listening to this?
Not sick.
Not sick.
Not sick.
Okay.
Healthy is a different thing. Somehow, that's hard. What is healthy? It's not always happy.
It's aliveness.
Aliveness. That's good. And that there's ground under your feet. There's always the ground. There's some ground. Whatever is, there's ground. And people understand you, and you understand them. And all the stuff that you didn't have to help you when you were sick, now you have help you when you're well. Like friends, like things to do and places to be. And knowing how beautiful it is, and having it available for you, and having all of these things available for you. Go be silly with your friends. I didn't have any friends to be silly with. And there are friends that you can talk to. I have a friend whose husband is beginning dementia. And she talks to me about it. And I can listen to her full out. And she can talk to me full out from her hara, right? It is... centered in the belly button. You unscrew the belly button and let go. You know about the guy who had a loose belly button?
No.
Well, he got the doctors to operate. They tightened up his belly button. He woke up and his ass fell off.
Joanne, in talking about the absence of things, you know, like that health isn't an absence of problems or an absence of illness.
Yeah.
Answering that question at the ISPS conference, part of what you also said was, I'll go back to the metaphor, if you stop drowning, then you actually can be dealing with the just ordinary life problems that most everybody else has, like work and relationships and trying to have enough money and just normal life stuff.
Yeah.
As opposed to just dealing in that state of being in a submerged, drowning kind of, I'm just fighting for my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in the hospital, we were really impressed by people with real problems. Oh, she has a real problem. Wow.
And what did you call a real problem?
Money, husbands, wives, families, children, blah, blah, blah. Because I hadn't been on a date. I didn't know. How do you talk on a date? What do you do on a date? Mm-hmm. How do you get with a bunch of people sitting around in college? How do you act in college? When do you do that? All that stuff you have to learn.
The term you used before about not, what was the term again?
Schwach.
Yeah. Which is kind of not a very lively version of being alive.
Right.
Just kind of, it's not depressed or something, it's just kind of not much energy, not much.
Right.
Which in a certain sense is I think a good deal of what Windhorse is about and the energy of Windhorse. But, you know, we think about people's urges toward health and urges toward being in life. And it's really amazing to me, given what you're describing, Joanne, about having so much time spent in really a deep part of an illness from the time you were a child and all the developmental stuff that, you know, you weren't able to participate in an ordinary way.
I remember going to Canada up skiing once, and I got invited when I was lying about going to college, and I was up in Canada with a bunch of kids and this family that I was with, and we were hanging out, and I was doing everything I possibly could. I was working away like 60. And one of the guys said to me something like, "Where do you go? You're not, kind of not with it." And I thought, these people are titanic. How do they do it? How do they do it? My God, they're giants, these people. They're real all the time. I mean, holy, wow. I don't think I can do this.
What shifted?
Huh?
What shifted?
I haven't the faintest idea. I don't know. I'm not saying that once it shifted, it didn't unshift, at least partly. I had about half an hour of a good old-fashioned Looney Tunes when I had a baby and I was pregnant with another one. And the baby was David, who it turns out has what you would call Asperger. And I was in New York, which is the worst place that anybody could be. And I was riding on a bus and I was back there. And there was a big difference because I said, it said, and I said to me, "What's this for?" Which I never would have said back in those days. What is it? Why is this happening to me? And what's it for? And what it's for, it turned out, the answer was right there. You've gotten easy. It's been easy. And we're showing you the difference between who you were and who you are. And I said, "Oh, all right." That's okay. Went away. Took about 3/4 of an hour.
Talking about the challenge of writing Rose Garden, and you mentioned that in any book, and in any good book, maybe there's 5 or so problems that one has to solve, or especially a psychological problem, at least one of them is, right?
Yeah.
And you've also mentioned this in conversations we've had. It resonates with what you said on other occasions about when you're writing, doing your creative writing, there's a problem that you fully engage with, and then it's the process of working out of that.
Yeah.
So I thought, when Deborah asked you, you know, what was the shift, and you said you had no idea, I had an idea, which was that you've become a master problem solver through the creative way you've lived and your own intelligence, that you've mastered problem solving.
Well, sort of, maybe. I mean, I haven't had them all yet. Right. I'm still working on being old. When you're old,
right.
The
right.
different pains yeah. are like little children. It's a, pay attention to me. No, pay attention to me. No, pay attention to me.
Becoming a master at problem solving, which I don't have any claim to be that, but I, at my age, I've dealt with a number of them. It seems like it's helpful to not be so horrified or locked into identification with the problem, as opposed to having some awareness of the fact that you're in a problem state.
Yeah.
Which it sounds like you were also.
Yeah.
You had the perspective you'd worked through with in your therapy and in your life enough to know that you could do that. You wouldn't have to identify and be immersed in the drowning with the problems.
Yeah. There is a book called Out of the Woods, an interesting book. If I read it right, this is a therapeutic hospital for teenagers that age out of it at 18. And they're all sitting around saying, there's a bunch of kids now who are 18 and they're getting ready to age out. What about, you think Mary will make it? You think Tom will make it? You think Agnes will make it? And they thought, well, yeah, I think he's got this, she's got that. No, I don't think he will, but I know he won't, blah, blah, blah. They didn't let that go. They came back in, I think, 5 years or 10 years and found out who did and who didn't. Some were no surprise. Some were big surprises. They began to have an idea of what made that happen, what was lacking or what was there that made this, and how can we guess wrong? How can we guess right? What are the things that you need to take with you? That, by the way, is the lesson of the Wizard of Oz. She is going on a quest with her heart, her brains, her nerve, and Toto, who is the cue, the quintessence, life force or whatever. And she's going to see the wizard, and the wizard is going to solve all these problems. The wizard is the wizard. And then he's a fake. And then he isn't. Then he's just a human being.
Right.
Who says, as he's leaving, that, I don't know how it works. I don't know how it works. I love that movie for that.
May I just jump in with something here?
Sure.
In the afterword.
I haven't read that, by the way, years.
Okay.
I haven't read it since I wrote it.
It's really fun.
You like it?
Oh, it's beautifully written, of course. And,
yeah.
And
you read any of the others?
I read In the Sign.
Did you like it?
I liked it very much.
It's Albert's favorite, of course.
What I wanted to read you, actually, though, from what you just said about the Wizard of Oz and saying, by the way, I don't know how this works.
Yeah.
In your afterword, people were asking you, what was therapy like? How did life feel? And then the toughest question, how did I recover, can't be answered because I don't know.
Yeah.
Which I thought that was...
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't. Honestly.
But as you talked about in I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, things started to shift. Clearly things were starting to shift.
Well, Chuck, we have this basic reference point in our Windhorse work, which is what Joanne was also referring to, about even as a 5-year-old, you know, there's this basic dimension of who we are that knows what state we're in, where we are, if we're sick or not, etc. And it seemed like our Windhorse work, we've made a point of doing everything we can to help a person access that, bring that out, that intrinsic ability to know, and which is also to know what to follow and what to refrain from, and knowing things, of how to help oneself, but the knowing seems like built in, and seems like we just work to bring that out.
And there's also all of that trust thing. Mm-hmm. James Lee Burke writes detective stories, and he said that there has to be somebody in your life who says to you, you're okay. And I think it probably can't be your parents.
Okay.
Somebody else.
Yeah.
Who you can trust, for whom you're okay. I used to go down to the prison with Max Frankel in between the Jewish holidays and bring stuff. And the people there were mostly not evil. I think there were people who were stone evil who were there. But most of them were feckless. They could reason from A to B, but not from B to C. You knew he was drunk. So why did you incite him? Well, somehow that connection is not made. I don't know why that is, but it happens. You see it. I see it all the time. Most of our clientele on I-7 were young male and drunk, and a lot of them were not able to reason from B to C. I mean, and a lot of it's funny. There's a lady tried to commit suicide, and we stopped her. She was furious with me because we had stopped it. And later she accused me of stealing her watch. And I thought, you know, yesterday you were going to die, and now you stole my... No, I didn't. I've got a watch.
What are some of the changes you'd like to see in the world of care for people with extreme mental illness?
That's a hard one. I think reality, even lousy reality, is so much better than anything we cook up in our illness. I think I would like to see as little medication as possible. I'm not against medication because what I had was mechanical, cold, wet sheet packs, which I wish would come back because they were terrific. You had restraints. It was good for you.
Right.
Nobody is going to allow that anymore because it's, quote, I think it doesn't look good.
But it was good for me.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to see those back. Depends, and of course, if you look at, the guy who wrote the three books, Mad in America.
Whitaker?
Yeah. He thinks they're torture.
Yeah.
Well, it depends who gives them, who gets them, and why, and for how long.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't do anything to your brains. And it slows you down.
Yeah.
Holds you.
There's a physiological effect. Yeah. But I'd like to see a much more careful use of drugs. I mean, I found out what Abilify was. They were advertising that as if you're feeling kind of blue, and there's nothing else to do. Try Abilify. What the hell is it? It's an industrial strength antipsychotic.
Yeah.
Take care of that. More people feeling good about life in general. Better pay. I mean, all kinds of things that help. Training is not as important somehow as being real people themselves.
Yeah.
I saw some pretty bad examples of highly trained jerks. But I think it's a fearsome thing you guys do. Because you don't know how it works. Sort of.
Yeah. Well, we jump off the diving board. Yeah. We're not sure if there's water in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily being highly trained. Like, for instance, did you know Courtney Harding Okay. She was one of the principals in the Vermont study, mm-hmm. and it was something like a 30-year longitudinal study of people who'd been admitted to psychiatric hospitals with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and then what was the recovery rates that they were seeing uh-huh. over time. And that was initiated back in the days when if you had been perceived to recover from that with that diagnosis, then that meant you didn't have it. That meant you weren't.
Oh, they still do that.
They still play that game. Well, she was really in the thick of it around that study, and they found that something like 50 to 55% of people with that diagnosis had really significant functional recovery, uh-huh. which was more in keeping with what the standards are around the world, but not in this country.
Yeah.
She used to come to one of our projects, Friendship House. She loved the place. She came there a couple times, and we asked her about what she saw as what people reported as being curative factors. Uh-huh. She said, "Well, it was almost never the doctors.
Yeah.
They liked the people who were maybe cleaning the room or asking them to help them take out some laundry or something, because they treated them like people."
Yeah.
Like ordinary people, as opposed to somebody that's you're sick. So that's the other side of the you're sick thing, is that it can also be such a stigmatizing thing that some people recoil from that. So it's kind of an interesting mix of recognizing your state of mind and state of life, but at the same time not being given some kind of a death sentence.
Both are true.
Yeah.
That's one of those lovely paradoxes we all have to eat. Yeah, both are true. I can name those people. I was in a rooming house and the lady who ran the rooming house, that page fell out, you know, the judgment page. I remember returning to the hospital and spending a week there and then coming out again. It was raining. And I walked all the way to the rooming house, which was at the edge of what was then Rockville, and there I was, and I rang the bell. She opened the door, and she said, "Look at you. What do they feed you in that place? Get in here. You're freezing cold and wet. And come in the kitchen. I've got some friends here, and sit down and drink some tea." I thought, "Lady, I will cut out my heart for you."
Wow.
Yeah. Olive M. Brown. And they're all over. They're peppered all over. Little, like raisins in your oatmeal.
In my oatmeal.
You have knowledge of the wind horse approach.
More or less.
And how does it resonate with your sense of what's helpful for people with mental illness? So I would say for me, just to introduce this idea of basic attendance,
uh-huh.
that people are intensely present in a simple way, I think is very healing.
Somebody is listening, really. And I can't say without judgment, because I think it's a lie that you don't judge. It's something else. Of course you judge. I think everybody judges when they get up in the morning, whether they're going to keep on or not, or what they're going to do. And I think we judge other people too. But it's more like evaluating. And the word judging it's had a bad connotation now. A kind of evaluating. So you're not just listening, you're listening with.
Deborah, in your description of someone being with you in a very present way, it was also expanded beyond just a therapy office into territory almost akin at times to what you described about the woman who invited you in for tea.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's very, there's all these very functional, practical aspects to it too, that if you need tea that day and if you need to go for a walk, That was it. Or if you need to plant some garlic. Yeah. So it's a very broad palette of what's fair game.
Deborah, could I ask you, so this being present as you were describing it, It reminded me of what Joanne was saying earlier about that you had to have somebody in your life who communicated to you that you were okay. And did you find that with these attendants, that they were, there was an atmosphere that whatever you were doing was okay and that you were okay? Did that
not immediately up? But after a while. I'm trying to remember the name of the book. Lewis was one of the first people to come to my house.
Yes.
And it was about Jacob and the angels. I don't know why it was so important to me that he read it, but he read it between one day and the next. And then we talked about it for a while.
Yeah.
It was very real. And it wasn't a part of me that was scared or sick.
I want to just note that was really an important thing I think you all just touched on there. And I think, Joanne, if you are game for us to have another conversation again.
I am.
It would be fantastic, because what you just brought up, this the spirituality and the path and one's path of healing and stability, it would be really interesting to get into that when we have time.
I would like to. I read a magazine called The Skeptical Inquirer. They're big skeptics. They also think religion is the same as guys shaking rattles with bones in their nose, and that anything, quote, spiritual is fake. And a big thing of mine is the medical model of psychiatry, which completely shuts off spiritual. One of the tough things my therapist did, Frida did, was to discriminate between creativity and insanity, and between religion and creativity. And she didn't bollocks up, which most atheists do, confuse between God, church, and religion. They see it as all one blob, which it is not. They're three entirely different things. Four, actually.
That was Windhorse Journal Entry 051. Swimming Lessons, the first of a series of conversations with Joanne Greenberg. Our heartfelt thanks to Joanne for hosting these intimate and generous conversations. Visit us at windhorsecommunityservices.com/journal to follow our series of writings and podcasts on the lovely and tempestuous Joanne Greenberg.
Windhorse Journal is a publication of Windhorse Community Services, supporting recovery from mental health challenges at home and in the community since 1981.